what you are basically. Deep, deep down, far, far in, is simply the fabric and structure of existence itself.
Peace for all men and women, for all men and women, for all men and women. Not merely peace in our time, peace in all time.
Honestly expressing yourself.
Peace for all men and women, for all men and women, for all men and women. Not merely peace in our time, peace in all time.
The fabric and structure of existence itself.
Hi everybody, welcome to the Parallel Mike podcast episode number 51. I'm your host Mike and thank you so much for joining us. We've got a very important episode tonight. We're going to be talking about the precious metals, particularly gold and silver. And I've got an expert on the show to discuss this with. That's Tom Bodrovics from Palisades Gold Radio. Now, I myself have been on Tom's show a number of times and we've become good friends since our first discussion. Now, I was going to save this episode for next week. However, with gold hitting a new all-time high, I thought I had to put this one out now. It's very relevant and very timely because I've been getting a lot of questions about gold the past week. People have been asking me, Mike, is gold overvalued? Is it too high? Should I be buying Bitcoin? Should I be buying Nvidia? So I really wanted to get this one out to give people some information as to why gold is always important to own, because it's God's money. It's been around as a store of wealth and as money for over 10,000 years. And in the US, it was literally written into the Constitution that only gold and silver should be used as money. Now, why is that? Well, look what happened after 1971 when the US and President Nixon took gold out of the financial system, turned it over to the banksters completely. We've had an explosion of debt. US debt is now nearing $35 trillion. And it took over 200 years to hit the first trillion, but get this. Since COVID, they're now increasing the US national debt by $1 trillion every 3 months. This is completely unsustainable, my friends. They've created the largest and greatest Ponzi scheme in human history, and this can only go on for so long. We've got $35 trillion in financial debt, but we've also got $95 trillion in private debt in the US. We've got corporate debt. The US also has $250 trillion in unfunded liabilities. That's money they have promised people that they simply do not have. But it's not just the US. This is a global phenomenon. Pretty much every Western nation is bankrupt. The whole commercial banking sector globally is certainly bankrupt. Remember the $2 to $4 quadrillion in financial derivatives. Of course, we know they are setting up to do bank bail-ins to take our deposits in the next financial crisis, but it's way worse than that. We've also learned from the Great Taking book, which I have done episodes on, that they're even setting up to take our retirement accounts, our stocks, our bonds, our pensions, our physical property if we have a mortgage or loan outstanding on it. So for all of these reasons, I wanted to get Tom on the show to talk to us a little bit more about gold and silver, about how he came to be an investor in gold and silver himself, what he's learned from interviewing thousands of experts over the years on his show, which is my own personal favorite gold and silver investing show on the internet. And ultimately, we turn this conversation in part two into a discussion around philosophy and how we are both preparing physically and mentally to survive harder times. So there's so much to take from this one. It's a very practical episode. A big thanks to Tom for coming on the show. Members, please head over to parallelmike.com to listen to the full episode. If you are not a member yet, please consider joining us to help support my content and listen to fantastic full-length episodes. And I've got some really fantastic guests lined up in the coming weeks, as well as a really great deep dive, which I'm going to be doing by myself next week. That is one not to miss. But before we get to any of that, I have this awesome episode to share with you. This is my conversation with Tom Bodrovics from Palisades Gold Radio. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you're all well, healthy, and reasonably happy. Like always, I'll see each and every one of you in the next one. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Parallel Mike podcast. We are joined today by precious metals expert and host of Palisades Gold Radio, Tom Bodrovics. Tom, when it comes to precious metals, I don't think there's anyone out there who's interviewed more other experts than yourself. You've interviewed everyone and anyone. And the reason I wanted to get you on the show today, Tom, was to talk about the debasement of fiat money, gold, silver, protecting ourselves going into financial hardship. So I've been looking forward to this one a lot, Tom. We always have a great conversation. How's it going today?
Excellent, Mike. It's always great to be on your show, and we always have a great chat in and around what the point of our conversation usually is. So I'm looking forward to it as well.
We always do a podcast before the actual show. We get talking and we've got a lot in common. So we have these big conversations, and I always think that would have made a great podcast in itself. So I'm hoping we draw some of the stuff out that we like to talk about privately as well. But before we get started, Tom, can you tell listeners, how did you first get interested in gold and silver? Because we've all got our own stories. Did anyone introduce you to it when you was young, or was it something that you came about naturally?
I guess I did have some influences, certainly, as one usually does. But, you know, in preparation for today, you sent me a couple of these topics, and I started thinking about it a little bit. And, you know, I wouldn't say that I had a normal upbringing, as you know, you just get to, you know, be a little kid and watch cartoons all the time and just play and stuff. My parents, especially my dad, was really hard on me about saving money, about working hard and instilling this work ethic in both my sister and I. And looking back on it, I am extremely grateful for it, because that, I think, made both of us who we are today. So, you know, growing up, I always had this real appreciation for what I had and really valuing what I had, because no matter what, even when I remember being, you know, 7, 8 years old and wanting a new motorcycle helmet. And my dad said, well, you can pay for half, I'll pay for the other half. And I remember picking rocks in the field and doing these crazy tasks that ended up making me value what I wanted as the end goal, and really taking care of my things because of that. Later on down the road, I think we talked about this last time, I ended up becoming a welder after high school, after deciding engineering wasn't for me. And I became, you know, very successful in that industry. I was the youngest to be doing a lot of the things I was doing. I had a very successful business. And, you know, that's not to say that it wasn't without the, let's say, sacrifices as well, because I was working 60 plus hours a week. I was paid based on, I was just exchanging my time for money at the time. And, you know, I loved parts of that industry. All that being said, my dad was always kind of doing research in investments and trying to understand the world from this other perspective, right? From this, let's say, alternative media perspective. Even back then, in that would have been, let's say, 2012, 2013, that this particular event actually happened. I remember, even as a kid, him trading commodities and understanding that, even at, I think it was 11 years old, meeting his commodities broker in the US. It was an interesting experience, and being exposed to that stuff as a kid, I think, really sparked this interest as well in me. So in 2013, my dad sent me an email that introduced me to this entrepreneurship camp from Simon Black. It was called the Blacksmith Camp. And technically, I was too old, because they wanted people under 25. They wanted young entrepreneurs under 25 to come to this camp in Lithuania. And basically, the camp ends up being paid for. You just have to get yourself there. And all the accommodations, all the lessons and everything are complimentary. But there, at that year, apparently there was a 3.2% acceptance rate. And somehow I got in. And that is, I would say, the real catalyst that started me down this road. I had traveled a ton before that, but never overseas. So I started my trip. I went to Hungary, Latvia, and ended up in Lithuania for the camp, because I didn't want to just go to Europe for a couple days. And at that point, that really, you know, I basically jumped in with both feet. I remember particularly one of the previous participants. We had dinner with him before the camp, and he said, no matter what you learn from the instructors, the most important piece that you're going to take from this camp is the connections you make and the people that you meet. And he was absolutely right. No matter what I did learn at the time, which was all extremely valuable, and I'm very grateful for that time in Lithuania, I ended up meeting my friend Colin Cattell, who started the Palisades. Back then it was called Palisades Radio. And he started the company right after him and I had met in 2013 at that point. And he, from his dad, was exposed to this whole industry of gold and junior mining. And he kind of started teaching me some of that stuff. We ended up traveling all over the world together for many years. Me being from Canada, him being from the US, we had never hung out in Canada or the US together. We were always in Guatemala or Portugal or, you know, any number of places, but we had never actually been in Canada or the US together. And we were both on this kind of journey of learning and trying to understand the world as two young guys, and some ways putting our heads together to understand the world from both of our very different perspectives. Years later, I was still welding and investing in his company, investing in junior mining companies, because this started to really make sense to me once I understood these lessons of really the precious metal space. And once I, you know, really got into that world, at the time when I was welding, it had become very repetitive. And so I would put my earbuds in the morning. Most guys would listen to music or just wear earplugs. I would wear earbuds, much like these actually. And I would just crush podcast after podcast after podcast for 10 plus hours a day, because I would work 10 hours a day plus an hour drive each way to get to work and back. So, you know, for 12 hours a day, I was just absolutely drinking through a fire hose any information I could get my hands on. And I would listen to everything at 1.5 speed. So I could not find enough material to keep me entertained. And I've always been somebody that is a voracious reader or consumer of information only in subjects that I am extremely interested in. When I was in school, I hated being forced to study things that I didn't have an interest in. And so this idea of mining, precious metals, economics, all of these different topics that we can all relate to were all very specific interests of mine. So, you know, through the years, Colin ended up getting really busy running all of the companies that he founded, and he had somebody take over the show for him. And in the tail end of 2019, I was down at his place in Puerto Rico, and I was kind of being critical of the new host that had taken over for him. I said, you know, I listen to a lot of podcasts. I think this show has great value. I think the guests have great value. And unfortunately, I don't think the host that you have is doing a proper service of using the time that he has with these particular people effectively. You know, I don't necessarily want to know every single person's book list that they're reading. They could, you know, he could have had Daniel DeMartino Booth on, or Luke Roman, any of these big names in the economic space. They could say the most profound thing and he would brush over it to his kind of pre-prepared list of questions that he asks every guest. And I understand everybody has a different style, but I just thought he was leaving a lot on the table. And a couple of weeks later, Colin, you know, phoned me up and he said, well, why don't you end up hosting the show? You know, you understand a lot about these podcasts. You made some really good points when we were together. You know enough about the gold space to be dangerous. And, you know, I think that perspective ended up making me valuable to a lot of my listeners, because I came at this from a background that I didn't have an economics background. I didn't have any type of a background that should lend myself to being good at that particular hosting job, let's say. But I've had several guests say that's what makes me valuable in that space, is because I can understand it at a high level, but I also want to understand it at a base level and help translate that to most people. So, you know, long-winded answer to your question there, Mike, but all very important pieces to end up getting me to that particular time of starting to host the podcast.
Yeah, and you do a fantastic job of that, Tom. I think your show is the best out there. And I don't just say that because I know you or because I've been on it or because we're friends now. I genuinely always thought that. So it was a complete honor when I went on the show. It was like, wow, this show is the best out there when it comes to gold and silver. And I think you contribute a lot to the world because of that, and particularly the gold and silver world. You give us these great guests. And a lot of them do come from a financial background. Unlike myself, I'm like you, I didn't. I was self-taught. Very similar style as well, like an autodidact. I just read constantly, listening to hours and hours of podcasts. I had a similar career in that I had plenty of time to do that. Mm-hmm. And I think that adds value in a different way because you look at things from a different perspective. Some people excel in looking at numbers and digits and charts and graphs. Other people excel at understanding the psychology of the markets. Other people, it's more the technical side. Everyone's got their own take on it. But going back to gold and silver, Tom, what was it about gold and silver that attracted you the most? Because I guess there's so many different areas of finance. And when you speak to people who have immersed themselves in a life of finance, it often is about money, charts, graphs. It's about options trading. It's about always trying to capitalize on the economic environment. Whereas in the gold and silver space, there's actually people who have an ideological attachment to those metals. It's more about escaping debt. It's about escaping a system that they see as corrupted and financially manipulated. So where do you sit on that one, Tom? Do you actually have that part of your own understanding of the metals as well, that it is about something more than just having an investment?
Well, you know, you bring up some interesting, let's say, points and keywords. And just to kind of close the loop on something before, the value that I try to put into the world is also Colin's vision. And I think I didn't understand this when I began the show. And he said, we are not going to ever take show sponsors or monetize through YouTube. So all of our content is absolutely free. And, you know, I appreciate your kind words about the show. But yeah, I just came at it from a beginner's mind, really. And we've always been sponsor free, I think ends up making us a little bit more valuable in the space because we're not just peddling somebody's product. And I think that, you know, leads really importantly into your next question, which is, you know, when I started beginning to learn about this stuff, there were, and there still are, very, I would say, sensationalist voices in the space. And I do my best to try to actually stay away from those because I don't think it's helpful for the precious metals space as a whole to be, you know, always crying wolf. And this is something that I think about deeply because, you know, if people are basing decisions on content that I'm putting out and that I'm choosing to put out in the world or guests that I'm choosing to spend time with, I want it to be as accurate of a worldview as I can present. You know, it's difficult to have a show and not have your own biases presented upon it. And I always try to really understand where my biases might lie and just focus on what the guest is actually saying. If they're providing a reasonable explanation of what we're talking about, you know, whether that is the peak oil subject is a good one that's very fresh on my mind because I just had an analyst on that thinks that there is no peak oil and he provided an excellent argument for it. And the challenging thing is to try to understand the world from a very objective perspective and try to understand why these people see the data the way that they do and if they provide a convincing argument for it. So all that being said, it can be really difficult in the gold and silver space to get away from these ideologues or these, you know, very sensationalist promoters of doom, you know, the end of the world. I was just reading a book recently, even just based on the demographics of Western societies and birth rates, like replacement birth rates, and just the challenge that ends up providing the financial system, the pension system, the debt system, all of that. So absolutely, part of it is just patience, right? This is not a buy this stock and it is going to skyrocket 20x in the next 6 months. This is not that. This is very much so an understanding of honest money and in some ways, old ways of protecting value. There are things that are much more exciting. There are things that are absolutely riskier, even though you can get that in this space as well, you know, in the junior mining side of things. But at the end of the day, this subject of precious metals and saving is a crazy topic. Especially in the West at this point, we're constantly driven to be always consuming, always needing the best and the shiniest, and saving part of your paycheck or not being in debt, again, is something that my parents instilled in me. And I don't always have the ability to understand people that use so much debt just to get through life. I have an aversion to debt. It's interesting, actually. You know, we talked about my trip to Africa, and I spent plenty of time with the market sniper, Francis Hunt, and him and I were talking about debt, and we ended up coming to the conclusion that we both actually missed the opportunity to use debt to our advantage when interest rates were in the basement. And while I don't regret that, I can see how that could have provided a leg up at times if you were to use it strategically and intelligently. But I also think that that ends up kind of driving behavior that I think that actually the best way to explain that would be the idea of recency bias, because we always think that tomorrow is just going to be like today. And when we look at this mountain of debt, this mountain of federal debt or international debt in front of us, at some point, this has to come toppling down. There are so many different explanations for why the US and Canada, let's say, have not really faced a serious recession in the last couple of years. And somehow this can just keeps getting kicked down the road. But let's say the Fed and the central banks have this ability to keep the markets afloat, to keep the system afloat, and really keep this, unfortunately, this dishonest system floating perpetually. And I think that once this actually comes to the fore of understanding exactly the problems that have been created because of this, whether it ends up being the credit market, whether it ends up being the derivatives market, there are so many corners that there can be basically a financial bomb hiding in that I don't know that they can keep these plates spinning forever. And it's difficult to understand how this has continued for as long as it has. And frankly, there's a lot of people that are frustrated by it because, again, in a lot of ways, I end up being, you know, somebody that distributes this information about precious metals. And unfortunately, the timing of a lot of this stuff just keeps getting pushed out and pushed out and pushed out. And I understand people's frustration with it. Absolutely. You know, kind of going back to this idea of an honest system, this has ended up basically punishing savers and people that are worried about tomorrow because they, you know, have not taken on debt to increase their net asset value. They have missed opportunities by investing in precious metals. But at the end of the day, this is a story of patience, I believe. And consuming less and saving a little bit for tomorrow is going to be something that I absolutely believe will ultimately pay off. In the beginning of February 22, I ended up interviewing Luke Roman. And I think it was a week into the Russia-Ukraine conflict. And I was going through the comments on the YouTube channel, and I saw a comment from a gentleman from Russia. And he said, basically, I've listened to the show for many years. I bought gold and silver, and everything that you and your guests talk about ended up coming true. There is zero cash available. There is no gold available. All of our accounts are frozen. And I'm very grateful that I was somewhat prepared. And I would love to have a conversation with you if you want. And so I got a hold of this guy right away, and I vetted him as best as I could. I believe I spoke to him for about 5 hours over two different calls. And there's a podcast that we did together that was, I think, just under an hour long. And, you know, this is somebody's perspective from a completely different part of the world than you or I can understand. And his savings and his investment in precious metals ended up giving him a major safety cushion and level of comfort in a time that their country was all but financially completely shut down. You know, he couldn't get cash out of the ATM, but he had reserve cash. He had gold and silver, which he didn't need to, but he could have started kind of bartering and transacting with that. One of the things that he regretted was not being able to liquidate some of his trading accounts because they took a big hit, obviously. But that's a perfect example of exactly why we do these things. And of course, this ends up kind of spreading into other areas of life, not just finances. This is I would say, kind of a holistic way of looking at the world. And we can, you know, discuss any of that at any point if you'd like as well.
You brought up some great points there, Tom, and there were so many ideas that came to my head as you was going through it. One of the things that I think is really important to touch on is this idea that it's about more than just capital and increasing our wealth or speculating. It's also about habits. It's about your personal attitudes to life. It's about principles and morality. And when you look around today, I think we've got a world that has been created through people seeking the expedient. They want something now. They want it tomorrow, immediately. And the financial world actually instills that upon us. You know, I did all of the right things. My wife did all of the right things. We went to university. We sacrificed. We lived in crap accommodation. And then we got to the point where we was looking to buy a house and we didn't want to take on the debt. We decided that actually that's a huge debt and the housing market was so overvalued. So we did the opposite. We lived on a tiny little boat and we saved our money, but our lifestyle was, I would say, far, far less comfortable, which doesn't always mean less enjoyable, but it was less comfortable than all of our friends who had massive amounts of debt and they were driving new cars and they were doing all the things that we were not doing. And if you looked at the two lifestyles, you'd say, well, they're the successful ones and we were the failures. The people who try and do things the legitimate way, they're often punished by society and they often also end up with less wealth, at least in the short term, because your house can go up in value 30, 40, 50% a year even. And that was the case for some years in Great Britain. And you've bought that house on debt and now you're getting the rewards of a Ponzi scheme, of a system where it's constantly infused with new credit, new debt is created and it pumps up these assets. And the people who are not doing that, who are trying to do it the old school way of saving and earning the wealth, they're actually left behind. So then they think, right, well, I've got to jump on board. And that's how it happens. And, you know, I've had the same experiences as you, but I think I have been rewarded in many other areas of my life. I'd say spiritually and morally by not taking that path because, yeah, I've got an aversion to debt. And similar to you, like I grew up, it was my granddad, actually. My granddad was an antiques dealer. So he used to deal in real assets. So he was always about physical assets. And I remember growing up, he used to always talk about Krugers. And I didn't know what they was at the time. But as I got a little bit older, he started teaching me about coins. And he said, you know, during the 1960s, when they banned gold, he said, then we had really high inflation. He said, I used to keep these, and he showed me what a Krugerrand was. And he said, I used to keep these under the floorboards. So I always knew there was something a little bit subversive about gold as well. Like it could protect you from, in this instance, it was the government. He was talking about excessive taxation and inflation. Mm-hmm. And like most young people, I ignored all of that and I went and lived my life. But as I got older, I started to understand the system. And then I thought back to him and I thought, wow, he really did teach me a lot. So let's go back to talking a little bit more about where we are today then, Tom. We've got this global debt time bomb, like you said, and it doesn't seem like it's ever going to pop. People always say, well, I said 10 years ago. And like you said, with gold, if you invested 10 years ago, you haven't had the best 10 years. However, what you are doing is preparing for that eventual collapse. And I live in Poland where we had a hyperinflation in 1989, 1990. So, you know, I've got these family experiences now of people who literally were going to the store and there was nothing there. There was no food. Most people lost everything in that hyperinflation. People think that in a hyperinflation, you can pay off your mortgage for pennies. It doesn't work like that. The banks actually revalue it in the new currency, and that happened here. And actually, they revalued it at a much lower rate. So people who had savings took like a 50% haircut. So over here, we've got these historic examples in our families and this knowledge. So we actually value things like precious metals. Everyone has a food store. Everyone's preparing for harder times. But in the West, we've not got there yet. But I can't help but think, Tom, that we're very, very close to those hard times arriving. And maybe it's like the boy who cried wolf. People have said it for so long. And everyone now thinks, it's never going to happen. But how do you see it? Do you think that we're getting close to that eventual debt collapse or some kind of monetary reset?
So, Mike, it's interesting to, you know, try to analyze this. And the problem is, despite what a lot of people tell you, and I think there are absolutely some honest actors in the space, anybody that talks about specific timelines, nobody has a crystal ball. This is something that, unfortunately, this community absolutely lends itself to understanding this, that there is this looming time bomb, yet nobody knows exactly when this is going to happen. And I think that this, it's absolutely gone on and carried on way longer than I think anybody ever expected it to. But at the same time, I think the important part about this, and this is something that I say quite a bit on the show, is that we're not worse off for adopting any of these steps, whether that is saving, living debt-free, preparing a little bit of, let's say, you know, even backup food, anything like that. We're not ever going to be worse off for doing any of these things. You know, you and I have talked before about the Great Reset. We did one of the first podcasts about that. And if that ends up playing out and you have debt.
Sorry, Tom, just to interrupt. It was the Great Taking for listeners.
Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. Those two terms are actually becoming linked now. But yeah, we was one of the first to do an episode on the Great Taking. It was months before anyone dared touch it. And yeah, it's exploded now, hasn't it? So I'll hand it back to you, Tom.
Yeah. And I've left it actually pinned to the top of our YouTube page, and it keeps racking up views. You know, I think we're over 70,000 views on something that initially didn't get a ton of actual attention. But if that ends up playing out the way it does, or the way that it is supposed to, then if you have debt and you owe the bank or you owe the system, you end up really being the loser in that case. Because like you said, not only are you in debt, the bank can decide to completely revalue whatever you owe them. And there's, you know, pieces of the depression that I think is really forgotten about. And that's the fact that they just basically took everything from everyone and kicked the legs out from the entire table, or let's say flip the entire board, the entire game board for everyone. And I don't know how people can honestly look at the system that just keeps compounding debt over and over and over and not think that that is a potential outcome from this situation. You know, the US dollar has been great for a very, very long time. It's been great for transacting, not a savings vehicle. But I think it's interesting to kind of go back to what you and I had touched upon with your grandfather, and actually my grandmother. My grandmother went through World War II in Hungary. She escaped to Canada. She immigrated here during the war. And I always joke, because we had to move her recently, and I always joke that she's always stocked up for the war. She has the most amount of absolutely everything of anybody I know. Like, she could get locked in her house for easily a year and be completely fine because she has all of the food. If you asked her, I need a number two fuse for this, she would have it. Somehow she has everything. And I think that is this old school mentality of these hard times, right? We know the saying that hard times make hard men or strong men, and good times make weak men. And I think we are in this part of the cycle, in this part of the empire, whatever you want to call it, where Western society is unfortunately starting to crumble. This system, this empire, is starting to lose steam. And this is a very predictable, very cyclical outcome that not many people want to actually learn from. And this is just a piece of history that rhymes again and again and again. And everybody thinks it's different this time. And unfortunately, I'm going to bet that it's not. This is not something, again, that I think we're worse off preparing for that outcome. If it doesn't happen, I maybe didn't make as much money as I could, but I was able to sleep at night because of this idea of preparedness and doing things the way that, you know, you brought the idea up of morality and honesty. To me, this is an honest way of saving and operating in the world. And that ends up being important to me, because at the end of the day, I would much rather be prepared for something catastrophic like this happening rather than being caught flat-footed on it and being caught unaware. You know, educating ourselves and trying to understand where the world is headed is part of the reason that I have so many different guests. And sometimes it is hard to kind of manage, but I think ultimately we end up basically being able to triangulate where we are in the world based on a lot of these different opinions. You know, I have gone out of my way to have people on that are very bearish on the metals, that are bearish on gold and silver, and think that this system just keeps going perpetually. And personally, I, again, acknowledging my personal bias in this area, it is possible that I don't believe their explanations, or I don't think they are very plausible because of my bias in this area. But trying to learn from history and trying to learn where we have come from and see these cycles repeating, I think that is far more instructive than just myopically focusing on the time that we're in right now.
You know, right now in the world, we've got gold and silver are a vote of no confidence in the system. So if you look at the system and you think this system cannot go on, these levels of debt cannot be sustained, they can't just print their way to prosperity, or worse, that system is going to be weaponized against you at some point, which has already started to happen. And it always happens towards the end of empires. And in part two, I really want to get into that specific subject, the end of empires and cycles. But if you think that that's where the system is, then gold and silver is the vote of no confidence. It's the insurance policy. And a key part of gold, and I would say the most important part right now, which is one that most people don't speak about, they value gold in the fiat system, in fiat notes. And I think that's really the wrong way to look at this. The way that I value gold is that it's got no counterparty. And most people have no idea just how much counterparty risk there is in the system. Since we did our episode on the Great Taking, and you know, I've done other episodes about the legal system and just trying to show people and evidence how all of these things that we own in this current fiat Ponzi system, that can all be taken so easily. And when the crisis does unfold, whether it's now, whether it's in 10 years, whether it's in 20, 30, 40 years, it doesn't actually matter, because on the day that unfolds, most of that wealth is stripped from the populaces overnight, because there's so many counterparties that will default on one another. And we have so many counterparties. And for listeners that are not aware what that term means, I just mean the links in the chain between you and the asset that you think you own. Mm-hmm. It turns out you probably don't own it. There's many people that are placed above you in insolvency. So if we have a global financial crisis, we're going to see all of the assets just taken, whether that's the Great Taking or not. There's many other mechanisms that could do that. And even if it was just a crash like 1929, you're talking a 90% haircut on the value of those assets, which would just destroy pension funds. It would destroy the futures of many people. So the great thing about gold and why I value it is that lack of counterparty. It's one thing that I can know that no matter what else happens, that's there. It's physical. It's real. Just like owning a house or having some land, but even more than that, because they can be taken. But you know, gold actually has no register, which is very rare these days to not have something put in a system. So I guess I'm going to hand it back to you, Tom. Do you view it more like that as well? Like, it's not actually necessarily about whether it's going to give me a 15x fold in the current system. It's more, it's there, it's real, and it's not going to zero. And nobody's going to take that without going to extraordinary lengths.
Absolutely. And I think that the idea of counterparty risk is extremely important. And it's not always easy to understand. But at the end of the day, if you just decide, okay, we're going to shut the lights off on this current system, what are you going to be able to actually transact with? What do you have at your immediate disposal without needing a card or another person to get for you? That is the ultimate, let's say, idea of counterparty risk. I traveled to Africa. I'm in the US right now, and I flew back down here just after Christmas. And I traveled with just a couple ounces of silver with me. And of course, I got pulled out of the security line in my carry-on, and the TSA agent was asking me, well, what is this? And he had zero idea about what really silver coins were and why I would need them. And of course, you know, in the security line, I'm not going to take the time to try and explain to him what it was. And I just basically said, well, it's just some silver collector coins, and just went on my way. You know, they don't have a problem with it. And most people just don't understand it. And going back to this idea of, you know, shutting the lights off, obviously that is absolutely a worst case scenario. And I don't know or necessarily think that that's how things are going to play out. I think that, again, this space kind of tends to lean to the very conspiratorial side of things. And I don't think that that is necessarily always helpful. But if we go back to the case of this gentleman that I interviewed from Russia, all of a sudden, they're not able to transact with the West. You know, if he had fiat notes in a Western bank account or a brokerage account or whatever it was, he's not able to access those. So again, it doesn't necessarily have to be just the lights getting shut off. As gold bugs, as precious metals investors, whatever you want to call us, I think we understand the value of having a fallback plan. And that, I think, is what this is ultimately about. Nobody knows how, again, not necessarily even when, but even how this is all going to play out. It would be wonderful, and you could make billions of dollars understanding how this is all going to play out. But at the end of the day, how are you going to be able to feed yourself? How are you going to be able to transact with anybody or anything? And what are you actually sitting on? And this is something why I have a problem with trusting cryptocurrencies. They've taken a lot of energy from the investing space. They have made millionaires, made billionaires. They have done a lot of things that makes them look very, very, very interesting from an investor's perspective, from a speculator's perspective. And I recently had a guest on the show say that he was finally converted and he understood Bitcoin. And the amount of just over the top enthusiasm is almost a warning to me. It was almost scary. And he even actually admitted this much. Once we released the episode, for I would say 2 to 3 weeks, it was constant mentions. Oh, welcome to Team Orange. You finally got your laser eyes. All of this, unfortunately, I would say, explain it as zealotry for Team Bitcoin. And as much as I think it's awesome to be able to wrap your head around something different, a new asset class, at the end of the day, how do you personally control those on-ramps and off-ramps? You know, the argument is always made to me, you don't need any electronics, or you can transact Bitcoin off chain. Okay. But what if you're just trying to buy some eggs or a little bit of meat from a farmer that has no use or no value for Bitcoin? What if it comes to that? What if they don't know how to transact off chain? How are you going to exchange value in digits on a phone or, you know, in an electronic wallet for something tangible that you need to eat this afternoon because you're starving? That to me is obviously the ultimate worst case scenario. But I've been in places in the last year where if you miss a meal, nobody's coming to help you. And while I don't think it is the end all be all solution to everything, I think it's absolutely an interesting asset class. But again, I think that there are a lot of counterparty risks involved with that, because not everybody is going to be able to transact and understand or trust any of these cryptocurrency systems and or Bitcoin itself as well. Obviously, alternate currency systems are going to spring up whether we get a CBDC or not, which I think is actually, I've become much less worried about over my learning on this subject, simply because I think that the governments of the world have done a lot to damage their own credibility and their social capital, if you will, over the last couple of years. Everybody knows what I'm talking about. You just have to look at the narrative and the lines that we were fed, and that amount of distrust and, you know, social turmoil that situation has caused is going to be a major counteractive force in trust in the government. And absolutely, I can see a situation where we are forced to try to adopt these things, that where the masses are forced to adopt these things. But as a person that has zero interest and that understands the ultimate aims of that system, gold and silver is my way of opting out of that.
You know, I've done a lot of work on Bitcoin myself, just privately looking into it. Mm-hmm. And
me too.
The problem that I found is that wherever I looked with it, it just had all of the hallmarks of a plot to get people to adopt something, to condition people for a new world, which they're trying to take us to now. It's the fourth industrial revolution. And if you look across all of the different sectors, if you look in health, if you look in finance, if you look at computer technology, communications, there are things happening in the world right now to condition people for that. Now, where's the one for money? Where's the one for the new economy? Where's the one for tokenization, digital contracts, blockchain? Well, if you don't see it happening, it means it's already happening. And I think that's what Bitcoin was there for. And I've had a lot of pushback against that because, like you said, there is cult-like thinking. And again, I always say to people, just be very careful, because if you're looking at a movement and any criticism in that movement is shouted down, or anyone saying, actually, that's not for me, I don't trust it, and those people are immediately attacked, and there can be no critical debate around it. There's no room for that. And people speak in slogans. They all repeat the same slogans. I say that looks to me...
You can't ban math.
Yeah, exactly. And it's got all of the hallmarks of any other psyop, like the LGBTQI people who are conditioned and they chant these slogans. And I don't want to offend anyone on this one, because I'm not saying everyone in the space is like that, but even people who are in the space will know what I'm talking about, that it has become so entrenched in a certain way of thinking. And yet I always say to people, with every narrative, there is one thing. Doesn't matter how good you think all of the other stories around it are, that one thing, if that turns out to be false, that premise, then it destroys everything else. And with Bitcoin, it would be, who created it? Was it created by the person we are told, which is an enigma, or was it created by US intelligence or DARPA or NSA or whoever? Now, if it turns out that it was, all of this rhetoric and all of this ideology around freedom and saving us and escaping the fiat system, that then all of a sudden is all incorrect. And it has another purpose, and that purpose could be very subversive. Now, people say to me, it's impossible, it was created by these people. They call them cyberpunks, I think. And I say, yeah, okay, well, who's the biggest proponent of Bitcoin today? It's Michael Saylor. Who does Michael Saylor work for? He produces the online portals for the Department of Defense, for NASA, for the US military. For all of the people that the Bitcoin is supposed to be opposing, he is one of the biggest holders, and he does all of the data mining for them. Who else works for intelligence? Elon Musk. All of his contracts are intelligence. He was pushing it. So I just say, just look at the people who are around it. If it was truly going against US interest, you wouldn't have Saylor doing it. He's a billionaire. He doesn't need Bitcoin. He was fine before Bitcoin. And yet all of a sudden he did a 180. So those are the kind of red flags that I look at. But whenever I point them out, I get the immediate backlash. So I keep my opinions to myself unless somebody asks me. But personally, I'm very, very skeptical of it, because even if all of that, what I just said, turns out to not be the case, and it was produced for some kind of freedom-orientated intentions, what we see happening in the space now with BlackRock and how it's being commandeered, that's taking it completely the opposite direction of freedom anyways. And it will be consumed by a system where all of the on and off ramps are maintained by the same people. At some point, the internet's going to be extremely hard for us to even access, particularly if you've got a freedom-orientated mind. So I think you need to have out the system solutions that have no counterparty at all, including the on and off ramps. And like you said, if I go to my neighbor and I take an old silver coin, she's going to give me the milk. If I took her or tried to use some Bitcoin, not only is that going to be tracked somewhere. And I got told a while back, Tom, about 4 years ago, that using the existing infrastructure, they can easily triangulate whose wallets are who without actually being able to break the wallet code. They're so sophisticated now in their data mining, they can easily just triangulating where your phone was, where you was, whose wallet was who.
I was going to say, of course, there's pushback on that. There's, you know, if you wash your Bitcoin in a pool, like I have done all of the deep dives. I've had a lot of these conversations. I've used it and transacted it with my own money. I went through this whole thing in 2016. I made decent money on Bitcoin or Dogecoin. I was a part of all of this stuff. I get it. I have researched the hell out of it. I absolutely wish I had bought it in 2013 when it was 25 cents. Somebody told me about it at that entrepreneurship camp. God, I wish I would have done that, right?
I mean, as a speculation, it's been fantastic and it still could be. That's not what we're discussing, I guess. We're discussing where it comes from and where it goes. That's how you invest well. That's how you risk manage well. It's by being skeptical of the things that you think and testing them. And if anyone tries to stop you from being skeptical or hide information from you, then I would say buyer beware. Like, you had been taken somewhere and it might not be pretty.
You know, Mike, as we're talking about this, it's so hard to cover properly all of these different things because, you know, going back and forth, you and I have so many different counterpoints. And that's why I'm looking down, because I'm writing down notes of things I want to make sure that I get to. This is a topic that is, there's so many different pieces of minutia to discuss and to understand. So, you know, going back to your point about the idea that they can figure out whose wallet it is. I don't know if you remember, but there was a pipeline terrorist attack in the northeastern part of the US. I don't remember exactly where. And part of the ransom for this, basically it was a software shutdown, was that they wanted to be paid in Bitcoin. Well, wouldn't you know, within a week or two, I believe 90% of that Bitcoin was recovered. But, you know, I think that this goes back to your bigger point. If the Bitcoin was recovered, then, you know, it's not truly untraceable. It is not truly anonymous. However, that is missing the forest for the trees. The bigger point here is that you're using this financial medium to push another narrative. And that is that it is, you know, super strong, unbreakable, totally anonymous. But you have these proponents of it that, and this is something I was thinking about for the last couple of days. And I think it's difficult to properly present my thoughts and feelings on it, because I simply don't have necessarily the words to be able to articulate it properly. But you brought up the idea that if, let's say, Satoshi Nakamoto isn't who he has been presented to be, this completely destroys the narrative for Bitcoin. And that I kind of disagree with, because if it has truly become a decentralized means of transacting with this supposedly system or free system that people voluntarily take part in and have the ability to change, then it should be free and have this ability. However, again, I think the most important part about any of these things is to try to step back and observe the forces within that space. As we're talking about it, this guy that came over to being, let's say, converted into the Bitcoin space received all this fanfare. And this is what I used that converted language deliberately, because we end up getting this feverish pitch around Bitcoin and this idea that, you know, this person finally sees the light. This is how it really seemed. You would never see all kinds of this same attention for somebody saying, you know, I've changed my mind on gold. And I think that's really instructive. I think that's really instructive from the perspective that there are so many voices now. And this is the part that I have a hard time actually explaining. There are so many forces that are so counteractive in the media today. And I think the best example I can give you is hilarious. You and I, obviously professional athletes at one or basically professional athletes at different points in our lives. And you see these news reports that fact checkers say that too much exercise is bad for you. But who are these fact checkers, right? There are forces in the world right now, or in the narrative, in the media, whatever ether you want to talk about, that have the ability to shape people's opinion on any subject, whether that be exercise, whether it be nutrition, whether it be vaccination, whether it be the water that you drink, the air that you breathe, whatever it is, even your religious beliefs, if you enter into that realm as well. There are so many different pieces of information that are presented that different forces have the ability to have sway over. And I think the most important point is to understand what the ultimate motivation for those forces is. Is it to make money? Is it to push people into a particular way of living so that you do become destitute and reliant on the system because you've taken on a whole lot of debt, because you have put all your money into Bitcoin? And again, this is absolutely not something that I discount. If you want to put 10% of your net worth into Bitcoin, I think that that's actually a really good thing, because you're open-minded enough to say, hey, this is something that has the possibility of working, and I'm adding this to my level of preparedness. If it goes to $1 million, great. But if it goes to zero, it is not something that is going to break. I find it extremely difficult to think that gold and silver are ever going to zero. And I have understood that subject accordingly. I don't ever want to be religious or completely binary about any financial opinion, any financial vehicle. I think that being open-minded is an extremely rare and extremely valuable skill, because I think it's a skill. And at the end of the day, I don't ever want to be thinking, you know what? I really wish I could go back and do something like that different. I wish I just listened and overcame my bias based on better information. And I just think that it is such a challenge in today's day and age to be able to actually sort through all the bullshit and all of the propaganda, because you can find any piece of information to reinforce any opinion you may have. And again, whether that is being vegan, whether it's being carnivore, whether it's being team Bitcoin, there are a million different topics that we can pick that are absolutely supercharged and weaponized in this day and age. And you can find way too many points to either side. You know, something as trivial as flat earth, who cares? How does it affect your daily life? But there are people that are willing to like fight and be cause stress by defending their point based on whatever information that they decide that they need to believe. And that's why, again, I try to take in as much information as I can, triangulate my position in the world. And when I see a very strong case on one side or the other, I really try to step back and understand what the possible motivations and or, you know, easily, an easy way to figure that out is to try to figure out where the money is behind either of those voices. And that, I think, is an easier way to, you know, basically a cheat sheet way to be able to get to that endpoint, which is understanding.
Yeah, I think it's a very wise way to look at it. I think it's a very intelligent way to look at it. And ultimately, you know, that's why I love elemental money. That's why I love gold and silver as a form of storing wealth, because it's pure in that it comes from nature's economy. It comes from nature itself, and therefore it's untampered with. Now, I'm not saying there isn't a lot of corruption and all kinds of things that happen in the gold market, but my point is that when you hold that, you know, there is no counterparty to that, and you don't have to believe any story or any narrative. You just understand that it's rare, that it comes from nature, and that's what it is. And yet with all of the other things, and we've seen this across all investing classes, people come along and they sell a story and they're cooking the books, or it's some big Ponzi scheme, or at some point in the future it's corrupted, or something terrible happens and it just disappears. And we've got thousands of years. And I would say as well, also, we've got central banks, the wealthiest families on planet Earth, who have all decided that that's their vehicle to, over hundreds and hundreds of years and generations, to store their wealth. And therefore, it just offers people a really simple way of cutting through all the noise, cutting through all the lies. Okay, maybe it doesn't go up tenfold, but maybe it does. Maybe it actually saves you in the great financial crisis if it does happen again, like it has done many people. And you mentioned the guy in Russia. That was a great episode, by the way. I really enjoyed hearing this guy, because that was right on the zeitgeist of it as well. It was just as it was happening. And this guy comes out and he talks about how literally his brokerage account was frozen and he was locked in his positions. And then it opened up like a week later and he was down 90-95%. These things can happen. They've happened many times before, and I think they're going to happen again, Tom. And like you said, with Bitcoin, if that's the kind of vehicle that you want to look into, that's great. But you always, always just have to have that critical mind. If somebody's telling you to go all in on something, that's never, ever been good investment advice. It's not with gold. It's not with anything. And it's certainly not with an asset where there is so many unknowns. So it's about having that skeptical mind, just being critical and not allowing yourself to fall into one of these boxes, which are all really cult boxes. So yeah, I'm open-minded on this stuff. But for me personally, I've seen enough from that space to know that it's just not for me. I don't want to be a part of it. And some people don't like that. You know, even though I don't force my opinion, I don't think I've ever done. In fact, I had Lawrence Lepard on my show and he talked a lot about Bitcoin on there. In fact, I've got a friend coming to stay with me next week who I met through podcasting. His name is literally Johnny Hodl. Like, he's an all-in Bitcoiner. He absolutely loves it. You know, I've got plenty of people who are completely different to me. And my only kind of prerequisite of having an acquaintance or a friend is that we can have conversations like this and disagree. Mm-hmm. Like, that's it. And like, I can have my take, you can have yours. And he always says to me, Mike, you convinced me to up my gold holding. And guess what? I own some Bitcoin because I allow people to pay me in Bitcoin. Because if they love Bitcoin, I want to make it easy for them to use it. That's fine. So I think that's a really good place to kind of end it for part one, Tom. I just want to hand it back to you though to see if you've got any final comments on that one.
You know, Mike, again, that point that you just made is really an interesting one, because you don't necessarily understand, you know, our full team Bitcoin. However, you accept it and you allow people to transact with you in it. You know, as voices in this space, and this is something I've thought about through my life. You know, I have mentored young athletes. I have been a journeyman in welding and had young apprentices. This is, in a way, the same thing. You and I have a responsibility, as I see it, which is to lead by example. And I want as many avenues open for myself, for yourself, for any of our listeners to be able to transact outside of this doomed fiat system. You know, you mentioned earlier about your grandfather having Krugerrands. My grandmother, like I said, she escaped the war. She came to Canada with basically nothing. These lessons are extremely important. And a couple of years ago at Christmas time, she gave me a $100 bill that she had saved in the late 70s. And I said, Grandma, you know, this is wonderful. I really appreciate it. And I want to sit down and, as a family at Christmas, being the nerd that I am, we sat down and I did the math to understand what the value of that $100 bill was now versus what it was worth back then, and what it, the equivalent of what it would buy you now. And I also did the equivalent for buying an ounce of gold, which you could have bought, let's say, an ounce of gold at that time for $100. And that ounce of gold now in Canadian dollars was worth, let's say, $2,600. And that $100 bill was basically worth $20 because she had saved it. It was in like 1979. That is exactly what we're talking about. That is the timeline that we're talking about. This isn't a super sexy, you know, crazy investment vehicle that is going to absolutely explode next week. This is something that is an insurance policy that you hope to God you never need. And I think that that is the ultimate piece that we need to remember about it. You know, this is something that takes time to play out, that takes patience. This is not a win-lose scenario for other asset classes. This is just about being self-reliant, having less counterparty risk than, you know, the average person, minimizing it where you can, having proper risk management, and understanding the cycles of history that are bound to repeat again and again.
Yeah, that's a fantastic response, Tom. And at every point in history, your grandma with her $100 bill or whatever it was in whatever country, there would have been something at that time that was promising to make her rich if she bought it. Whether it was mm-hmm. the tulip bubble, whether it was the South Sea bubble, whether it was tech stocks in the year 2000, whether it was the railway stocks in 1850, there was always something. There was always a narrative. There was always an asset, a financialized asset that you could have bought that was promising you to make you rich and retire. It never happens. It never, ever happens. It might happen for a period, but over time, market forces assert themselves. And what was once the greatest thing becomes something that nobody wants. Now, I'm not saying that's going to happen with Bitcoin at all. I'm just saying throughout history, there has always been these stories. There's always been the people who say it can never, ever go down. But at some point, it does go down. The great thing about gold is that throughout history, it's always been there. And like you said, it doesn't mean that it's going to make you rich, but it's lasting, it's enduring. And I actually don't know a time in history where I couldn't teleport you now and it's not useful, unless it was maybe some savage society where it was just literal hand-to-mouth survival. But anytime you've got an economy, gold and silver was valuable. And we still have an economy. And I think we always will have, in the very least, even in the hardest times, we'll have a trade and barter economy.
You know, it's interesting that you bring that up. This is another point that I had kind of thought about that I did want to bring up, is this idea that we can cherry pick any piece of data from any point in history to reinforce our point as well, right? You can literally say, you know, during this time, gold went up this much. Well, how about for the last, you know, excluding, let's say, the last 4 years, let's look at gold over the last 10 years. The nominal price change, and again, this is something that you brought up, and this really important. You can absolutely cherry pick any time in history to make any asset look amazing or horrific. And understanding the long haul or the long arc of history through the lens of gold as a very stable preservation of wealth vehicle is extremely important. And I think that is the ultimate vehicle to be able to, as you said, like transcend time with in a value preservation perspective.
Awesome. That's a great way to close off part one. Tom, thank you so much for your time. I'm going to put the links in the description. Is there anything that you want to say to listeners? Is there anywhere where you want to direct them to find more of your content before we go?
If people want to, they can check out Palisades Gold Radio anywhere and everywhere that they want to listen or watch, you know, Rumble, Odyssey, YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever. But I think the biggest thing that I would absolutely try to leave your listeners with is to just really look at everything with a critical eye. Don't just swallow the narrative that you have been given, whether that is in gold, whether it's in Bitcoin, whether it's in, you know, an article I was reading this morning that Cathie Wood's ARK ETF, she has wiped out an estimated $14 billion in shareholder value over the last 10 years. There are so many of these different vehicles that are lauded as absolutely sexy. Take a second to question everything that you're reading, whether it's gold, silver, Bitcoin, ARK ETF, health advice, especially. Figure out what works for you. Figure out what makes the most sense. And as controversial and as threatening of a phrase as it is, do your own research and figure out what point makes the most sense for you.
Smart words, Tom. Very wise. Really appreciate you being on the show. I appreciate speaking to you, knowing you, being a friend. And I'm really looking forward to part two, where we're going to get into discussing more about cycles of empire. And I've got some questions that I want to put to you about psychological toughness too, because I know that's a big part of both of our lives. So thank you again, Tom. And I look forward to part two.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it. And always a pleasure and a privilege to speak with you as well.
Okay, we're going to leave it there for part one, everyone. I hope you enjoyed it. I had a fantastic time making this episode, but we've got part two still to go. Now, in part one, we spoke all about gold, but make no mistake, gold is just a tool, a very important one. But ultimately, what's going to see us through hard times is our mindset. It's going to be our principles. It's going to be our readiness for taking action. It's going to be our adaptability. So in part two, we continue talking about gold, but we also start to talk about how we are getting ourselves ready psychologically. Not many people know this, but Tom is an elite athlete. He's very modest, but he's an elite athlete, and he does an awful lot of training, a lot of sports psychology. And of course, he also does this to get himself ready for harder times too, not just for sports. I was an athlete as well, which is why we've got so much in common. So in part two, we talk about that. We talk about what we do in our respective lives to get ready for the coming difficulties. And I think that is a key part of this. Simply buying gold and sitting at home and being a slob, that's not going to work. We have to get ourselves in order. That's what I'm all about. And I know if you're listening to this, that's what you're all about. So please come join us over in the members section on parallelmike.com to listen to part two. I'm looking forward to seeing you there. For those that are leaving us here, stay well and healthy, and I'll see you all in the next one.
What you are basic. Deep, deep down, far, far in, is simply the fabric and structure of existence itself.
Peace for all men and women, for all men and women, for all men and women. Not merely peace in our time, peace in all time.
Honestly expressing yourself.
Peace for all men and women, for all men and women, for all men and women. Not not merely peace in our time, peace in all time.
The fabric and structure of existence.
Not merely peace in our time, peace in all time.